said, though, the U.S. is China's largest trading partner. So out of that those 20% exports, 15% goes to the U.S. and around 15% goes to the EU. You know, and EU is going to contain a lot of those 70 countries, right? And at the same time, the U.S. relies on China much less than China relies on the U.S. in terms of exports and trade, because trade in general is only 25% of the U.S. total GDP. So I think, you know, as you're trying to figure out how to compete with each other, the governments of both countries are looking at these numbers and trying to say, well, you know, on the one hand, we want to keep trading with each other because otherwise we're going to suffer a lot and maybe we'll lose domestic political support. On the other hand, you know, what are the other things we can do? So for the U.S., they're thinking, you know, how can we shift our reliance on China to other countries, right? And how much can we rely on domestic economy, our domestic economy, to keep us going? And China's thinking, these 70 other countries that we're trading with, how much can we build up trade with them to substitute what we'll lose with the U.S.?
Professor Chen, we want to thank you for being with us. Nancy Chen is professor of economics at Northwestern University in Chicago, co-director of Northwestern University's Global Poverty Research Lab, also founding director of the China Econ Lab. We will link to your piece for Project Syndicate headlined Americans Can't Win from Trump's Trade War. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Sudan's government says the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group has killed at least 2,000 people in the 3 days since it seized control of the city of Al-Fashir in the Darfur region. The World Health Organization has condemned the reported killing of 460 patients and their companions at the Saudi maternity hospital in Al-Fashir. The fall of Al-Fashir is seen as a major blow to the Sudanese military. The city has been besieged by the RSF for 18 months, leading to widespread famine. Civil war in Sudan erupted in 2023. Since then, more than 150,000 people have died across the country, and about 12 million have fled their homes.
For more, we're joined by Mathilde Wu, Sudan Advocacy Manager at the Norwegian Refugee Council. She's joining us from Nairobi, Kenya. And we're joined by Nathaniel Raymond, Executive Director of the Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health. The lab has been monitoring Al-Fashir for the duration of the siege. Welcome you both to Democracy Now! Mathilde, I want to go to you first. Have you reached Norwegian Refugee Council workers on the ground in Al-Fashir? What do you understand has taken place? Can you talk about what you know of the Saudi hospital and the hundreds killed there?
And what's happening is no less than a mass calculated, long planned campaign of destruction and annihilation, a mass slaughter of civilians, deliberate attack on civilian infrastructure, like the hospital that you just mentioned. It just became a killing ground as hundreds of people were sheltering in it. And it's not only in Al-Fashir. Anyone who is trying to flee Al-Fashir right now is subjected to horrifying violence. My teams are not in Al-Fashir. No one is. There hasn't been any organization allowed to deliver assistance into Al-Fashir for the past 500 days. But we're receiving people who have managed to flee, who have survived it, 60 kilometers of horror, of looting, of attack, of rape, mass detention. And it's just overwhelming to see this mass atrocity unfolding, we speak.
And Mathilde, could you talk about the fact that so many people, as they're fleeing, are also being killed, raped, assaulted, detained?
You know, what really strikes us is that we are in this town called Tawila, where we're receiving the people who are fleeing. And there's only a few thousand people, actually a little bit more than 5,000 people, who've managed to reach Tawila. But we know that 10,000 of people are trying to flee Al-Fashir. So where are all those 10,000 of the families, you know? And we really fear that they're being attacked. We know of mass detention on the way. We know that men are being separated and then detained. The women who've managed to flee are telling us that they've been raped. One of the things that strike me the most is that when I look at the data that we have from Tawila, one in 10 families have children that are not their own. You know what that means? That means that the parents have disappeared. That means that the parents have been killed on the way, and that those children have just had to run with other families in order to arrive in Tawila with nothing else but unknown people that are protecting them.
And I'd like to bring in Nathaniel Raymond. You are the executive director of the Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health, which has been monitoring what's happening in Al-Fashir in the last for the duration of the siege. Could you tell us what you found?
What we've seen in the now over 72 hours since RSF has taken control of Al-Fashir is quite simply the sum of all our fears over the past year and a half. We see clear evidence of house-to-house killing, as evidenced by the appearance in the street and by the berm, the earthen wall surrounding Al-Fashir, of objects that range from 1.3 meters to 2 meters in satellite imagery. Why that's important is the average human body, when laid on the ground horizontally, measures between 1.3 to 2 meters. Additionally, we're seeing around those objects, in many cases, a peculiar red discoloration in the initial imagery collection. We believe that red discoloration can only be explained by blood, given our processing of those discolorations. They are all the same color, which is called true red. Additionally, we see by the earthen wall on the first day of RSF control, these objects consistent with bodies, consistent with the videos RSF themselves have posted of them shooting men in a trench near the wall. On the second day, the images we collected showed that those objects had not moved in the intervening 24 hours, but in fact, those objects had increased in number, and that vehicles consistent with RSF vehicles with gun mount, basically large machine guns mounted in the back, were patrolling along the wall. And again, we saw the red discoloration on the ground. So right now, we can conclude with high confidence that RSF is killing at a scale and a velocity that I haven't seen since Rwanda.
The Yale Humanitarian Research Lab worked with the Biden administration on Sudan and warned something like this could happen. Can you elaborate on this and also talk about the role of the UAE, the United Arab Emirates? Tell us who the RSF are.
Thanks, Amy. The Yale Humanitarian Research Lab, were part of a program under the Biden administration called the Sudan Conflict Observatory. In the summer of 2023, we privately met with the United Nations Security Council and warned them that Al-Fashir could potentially be under siege within months. And if Al-Fashir fell, it would result in mass killing of civilians. Additionally, we sent an emergency warning within the Biden administration, which rose to the level of the National Security Council and the highest levels of the U.S. intelligence community, saying that we believed Al-Fashir was in danger. We reiterated that warning internally in the U.S. government in the fall of 2023. We became extremely frustrated with the process within the government about how the threat to Al-Fashir and other populations in Darfur was being handled. And so we did not renew our contract and we left to go independent in the winter and spring of 2024 when the siege began in Al-Fashir. And so point you bring up about the United Arab Emirates is critical for people to understand. Robbie Gramer and a team at the Wall Street Journal reported what I think is the most important story in the world right now on Monday, which is that U.S. intelligence assessments that they have seen shows the U.S. intelligence community knew that the United Arab Emirates, a U.S. major defense partner, that's an official designation, has been arming the rapid support forces, and that arming has increased in recent months, including with weapon systems that the Wall Street Journal identifies that our team at Yale had identified in the fight in Al-Fashir. So what we know from the Wall Street Journal is U.S. intelligence knows that a U.S. ally has been arming the group committing acts that are tantamount to genocide in Al-Fashir.
Well, Nathaniel, one of the things that's interesting or perplexing about this is that whatever ceasefire talks have occurred so far on Sudan have occurred under the auspices of the Quad, which includes the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates. So given that it's so transparently party to the conflict. How does one explain that?
One explains that by simply saying that Western relations with the United Arab Emirates have mattered more than the lives of the people on the ground in Al-Fashir for the entirety of Sudan's civil war. If the U.S. wants to show real leadership right now, and we're talking a situation that's unfolding in hours, if there is any hesitancy to act, every day, we're talking literally thousands of people dying a day. We could surpass the death toll of the past 2 years in Gaza reasonably by the end of this week, given the amount of bodies we're seeing on the streets. And so right now, all pressure needs to be on the United Arab Emirates. There is no other option. And as long as the United Arab Emirates gets to skate on arming a genocidal actor, this isn't going to end.
And Mathilde Wu, before we conclude, I'd like to ask you about the humanitarian aid that's getting into Sudan. Sudan is the worst humanitarian and displacement crisis in the world at the moment. There have been massive cuts in aid. The Trump administration has cut billions and billions of dollars of funding to U.S. aid. In addition to that, the U.K. and the EU have cut humanitarian funding. What's the impact of that in Sudan?
The fact is that we can barely save lives. We're just really delaying death right now. I mean, all over Sudan, there are like multiple crises, starvation, sieges, cholera outbreak, you name it. Everything is in Sudan. It's the largest displacement crisis, largest hunger crisis. And sadly, the funds are not there at all. It's not even half of what we need is actually disbursed at the moment. And more than that, even when we have the fund, it's extremely difficult to work in Sudan. The warring parties have deliberately obstructed humanitarian assistance inside the country with an array of bureaucratic impediment, but also just simply with the siege. Once again, Al-Fashir, if one, the only reason why there hasn't been any assistance there is because it's been impeached, and it's because there's been a deliberate attempt to prevent assistance, trucks, people from reaching these hundreds of thousands of civilians who are just being starved.
Finally, Nathaniel Raymond, can you explain what's at stake with this war?
That's a really critical question, Amy. What's at stake with this war is not just the lives of civilians on the ground, but it's really the future of the responsibility to protect movement. Everything that has been happening in the past 30 years since Rwanda and Bosnia to build mechanisms legally, operationally, to respond to mass atrocity crimes. The failure to prevent what is arguably the most accurately predicted and the most accurately warned mass atrocity in history really is about more than Sudan. It's about whether the international community cares anymore about civilian protection for mass atrocity crimes. The answer Al-Fashir is giving us is no.
Nathaniel Raymond, I want to thank you for being with us. Nathaniel Raymond is the executive director of the Humanitarian Research Lab at the Yale School of Public Health. We also want to thank Mathilde Wu, Sudan Advocacy Manager with the Norwegian Refugee Council, speaking to us from Nairobi, Kenya. Next up, we go to Cuba. Stay with us.
Una canción de amor esta noche. Inesperada para mi voz, una canción de amor y de goce, una canción de amor de los dos, una canción chorubiada, una canción chorobodiada. Lloro virada, una canción lloro boría.
Cuban artist Silvio Rodriguez performing at the Summer Stage Concert in New York City, back in 2017. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show in Cuba. On Wednesday, the United Nations General Assembly voted to condemn the U.S. embargo on Cuba for the 33rd consecutive year, with 165 countries voting in favor of a non-binding resolution calling on the U.S. to lift the embargo, while seven nations that the U.S. reportedly pressured voted against it, including Ukraine and Israel. On Tuesday, Trump's U.N. ambassador, Mike Waltz, broke with tradition to give a long speech from the stage at the U.N. General Assembly during the debate on the embargo, urging countries to reject the resolution. Waltz was also Trump's national security advisor and infamously set up a signal group chat earlier this year to discuss plans to bomb Yemen, and then accidentally invited Atlantic editor Jeffrey Goldberg to join. Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez Padilla made a point of order as Waltz spoke.
They undermine democracies in our hemisphere.
I'm very sorry to interrupt, but there's a point of order from Cuba.
Sure. Madam President, yes?
Yes, we have to give the floor to the point of order and the representative of Cuba.
The permanent representative of the United States not only lies by substantially deviating from the topic, but also speaks in a rude and arrogant manner. Mr. Walsh, this is the United Nations General Assembly. This is not a signal chat, nor is it the House of Representatives.
Wednesday's vote came as Hurricane Melissa struck eastern Cuba after hitting Jamaica, causing major damage but no reported deaths after more than 700,000 people evacuated. For more, we're joined by two guests. Mikhail Wolf is associate professor of history at Stanford University, specializing in Latin America and the Caribbean. He wrote a Washington Post piece headlined, "When it comes to hurricanes, the U.S. can learn a lot from Cuba." And in the eastern Cuban province of Santiago de Cuba, we are joined by Liz Oliva Fernandez, a reporter with Belly of the Beast who's on the ground covering the storm's impact. Liz, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you explain what happened? I mean, we're talking about, we don't know how many deaths in the rest of the Caribbean, from Haiti to Jamaica. What happened in Cuba?
Well, thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure for me being here. Well, in Cuba, no one's death. There is no casualties that we can, there is no human lives that we lost. That's because the labor and the work of the civil defense of Cuba, something that I'm pretty sure that the professor Mikhail has a lot to say about that. But I'm just going to say that United Nations has been writing down that Cuba is one of example, is a role model when we talk about risk management disasters.
I mean, 700,000 Cubans were evacuated leading up to this storm. If you can describe how that happened and what that model is.
Yeah, well, this is something that starts before the hurricane touches land. The work of the civil defense started like really early in this Tuesday morning. So sorry. So they're trying to evacuate as many people as possible. And they, for example, the way they look is the way they is focused on prevention. For example, if you live close to the coast, or if you live in a house where the infrastructure is weak, you're gonna be evacuated. That there is a different kind of evacuations that we have in Cuba. For example, some is that you are taken to a government institution. They are going to take care of you. And the other one is you are going to a house that could be a friend, a family, a relative, a neighbor that is going to host you during the hurricane because their house is like better prepared for facing an hurricane than yours. So, but it's not just evacuating people. I think like the way that the Cuban informs the population is really good. Like I did a report where people were talking about, like, they were like 5 days before the hurricane came, talking about, okay, this is a huge hurricane. You need to pay attention. You need to follow the news. If you don't have internet or connection or any sign, because the power, the electricity power grid is down, they just going around the street in a cars, like talking to the people, screaming that stay in your home, don't let you down. And they trying, I think, like in Cuba, we have a really good culture about what is the things that we need to do in order when even a hurricane is came to our country. And I think like people already learn about that. People really listen to the civil defense. People really listen to the news. Sometimes we have casualties, for example, in Hurricane Sandy in 2012, that was also in Santiago de Cuba. We have casualties in that. So every time that something like that happened, I think like the work of the civil defense strength, people learn more, because many of these casualties are because indisciplines, because you say don't walk through the hurricane, because during the eye everything is calm, but then the storm start again. And I think that in this point, people are really aware of the dangers of surviving or facing a hurricane. And right now, Santiago is really calm. They just start the work of trying to normalize the life, trying to clean the roads, because here in Santiago City, the main sign of a hurricane just go through is like you have a lot of downs from the roots laid down on the streets. And it's like the panoramic after a hurricane was like the entire picture of Santiago de Cuba has already changed. It's like you barely recognize on a street or a neighborhood, but because they're full of treats on the floor.
I want to go to the Cuban foreign minister, Liz, Bruno Rodriguez, speaking at the UN General Assembly yesterday.
En las últimas semanas,
in recent weeks, the deployment of pressure, intimidation, and toxicity by the U.S. Department of State has been brutal and unprecedented on a large scale, so as to force sovereign countries to change their vote on the resolution that we adopt today. They have deployed all their weapons, in particular cohesion, but the truth, the law, reason, and justice are always more powerful and conclusive.
So, Liz, if you could respond to that, I mean, the impact of this economic embargo and how Cuba nevertheless has the resources to mount this response to the hurricane.
Well, that's a really good question, because the sanctions is affecting all the aspects of the Cuban lives, and the response to the disaster is one of them, because we don't have enough money right now. Well, the government doesn't have enough money to put in health or in public education. So they have like another kind of priorities. Imagine the amount of money that we have to recover a country after a hurricane, as Melissa just passed by. It's insane. Like, I think, and this is one of question that I have for myself, how is going to Cuba to being recovering after this hurricane passed? I don't know. I don't know how long it's going to take to Cuba to fully recover, not just from this hurricane. We talk about, we are in an island in the Caribbean. We face a lot of hurricanes and storms. So how Cuba is going to recover for that, I don't know. Because certainly this hurricane is hitting Cuba, is hit Cuba in the middle of a deep economic crisis, increased on the top of all by U.S. sanctions, because the goal of the sanctions is to cut Cuba of all kind of foreign investment, all kind of foreign currency that can come through tourism, through international medical missions. So they are trying to dip Cuba in an economic crisis. They're trying to overthrow the Cuban government. So cutting Cuba from funding is one of the ways that they are trying to do it.
Liz Oliva Fernandez is speaking to us from Santiago de Cuba. We're going to go right now to Professor Mikhail Wolf of Stanford University. You wrote this piece a while ago about, when it comes to hurricanes, the U.S. can learn a lot from Cuba. If you can talk about that and put it in a larger context of what has just taken place at the UN. I mean, it's happened year after year after year around the U.S. embargo that crushes Cuba and also penalizes other countries from trading with Cuba.
Yes, thank you, Amy. Thank you for having me on. It's great to hear from you, Liz, too, on the ground in Santiago. So the article I wrote a few years ago in the Washington Post occurred in the context of another hurricane that was hitting New Orleans. And, you know, if anybody was around 20 years ago, this is the 20th anniversary of Katrina that destroyed much of New Orleans and the most vulnerable populations there. Compared to what happened then when FEMA was really inactive, was not responding to that under the administration of George W. Bush, Cuba was handling these kinds of disasters really in an exemplary manner. As Liz pointed out, the United Nations, the Oxford International Development Organization, all independent experts on hurricane preparedness or disaster preparedness in general, have praised Cuba because of the way that it's so comprehensively handles and prepares the population for disasters and has organizations, has people on the ground on the local level who know exactly what to do when they prepare for these hurricanes. And this goes back many decades. I'm a historian, and this interested me. You know, how did this come about? It came about very early on in the revolution. A huge hurricane named Flora in 1963. So this is just a year after the missile crisis, 2 years after the Bay of Pigs invasion, struck the same area of Cuba that Melissa just struck. It was a different kind of hurricane. It did a kind of a loop, double loop around, and it killed about 1,200 people, caused a huge amount of damage. And during that, Fidel Castro actually personally led rescue operations. And the lesson that Castro and the revolutionary leadership learned is that you needed a much more comprehensive kind of response. And the civil defense is what came out of that a few years later. Embedding the civil defense within many different kinds of departments and organizations all across Cuba. So, Liz mentioned that, you know, people are educated. People know what to do. Some of the most popular people on the news in Cuba are meteorologists. People listen to their meteorologists in Cuba. And in fact, meteorologists are probably the only ones that are not criticized by Cubans in Florida who criticize regularly criticize the Cuban government. I've seen the Cuban dissidents and Cuban critics basically broadcast Cuban meteorologists based in Cuba uncritically. And this is something they never do for anything else. In this context, you know, Cuba is...
We have 20 seconds, Professor.
Yeah, sure. So obviously the embargo affects this. It affects Cuba's ability to recover from these and is often weaponized right in the moment when Cuba is the most vulnerable. So the two go definitely hand in hand and have for decades.
Well, we want to thank you both for being with us. History Professor Mikhail Wolf of Stanford University speaking to us from Palo Alto. He specializes in Latin America and the Caribbean. And Liz Oliva Fernandez, Cuban journalist with Belly of the Beast. We will link to her reports. You can also go to our website for an interview with them in Spanish. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Are you an artist, band, or record label? We want you to send us your music so we can put it on the radio. Not only this station, but stations across Canada. Check out earshot-distro.ca and share your music with more than 100 radio stations and programmers across the country. Earshot Distro is made by and for the campus community radio sector to help emerging musicians. Uploads cost $7 per song or $50 per album. Learn more at earshot-distro.ca.